Welcome to the Club Letter. This is for members only, in other words, those who have invested in BizNews Premium. Thank you for your support. And from today, we'll be giving you a lot more value in this part of our podcasting operation. Today, we're picking up with Merin Somerset West. She is Bloomberg's personal finance consultant and columnist, indeed. And she spoke with Rob Arnott about the AI bubble, some uncomfortable issues that come back to those of us who've been around the block a few times. And certainly it gave me pause. I've got a feeling it will for you too. But for now, let's join Merin and Rob.
So let's start then with that report that you wrote in March. You basically what you're doing is you're comparing it to the dot-com bubble, which really was a proper bubble, an obvious bubble from so long in advance. And back then we looked at that bubble, all of us, and said, well, that's a bubble, but we couldn't tell you when it was going to burst. So one of the things you do is you compare the AI bubble, which is going to call it a bubble for shorthand here, the AI bubble with that bubble. So let's talk first about what's similar, what is the same between these two situations?
You've got frothy valuations. You've got a spread in valuation between growth stocks and value stocks that's become, to borrow the British term, ginormous. You've got a spread in valuation between large cap and small cap stocks that's at record extremes. Now, one of the things that people say now that they also said in the dot-com bubble is, this isn't a bubble. This is real. Back then they said, the internet is going to change everything. It'll change how we buy and sell goods and services. It'll change how we get our news, how we do our research. It'll change how we interact and network with friends, with family, with clients. It's going to change everything. And these are the dominant players. And they're going to build our future. Most of that was true.
All of the first bit was true, right? All of the first bit.
Yes. Yeah. Now, where the narrative failed is that newcomers came in, competed, and the leading players weren't all leading players 10 years later. In fact, the 10 most valuable tech stocks in the world coming into the year 2000, 0 out of 10 beat the S&P over the next 15 years. You had to wait 18 years for one, Microsoft, to actually edge past the S&P. 18 years is a long time to wait. The other things that happened were the adoption of the internet happened slower than the advocates expected. The adoption of AI is happening slower than the advocates of this revolution suggest. So the narrative, AI will change everything. My goodness, it absolutely will. It's breathtaking. Anybody who's used ChatGPT-5, it's astonishing how intelligent it is. We wrote an article, Fundamental Growth, that's on the internet and is likely to appear at a journal early in the new year. And we gave it to ChatGPT 5.0 and said, tell us what's good and bad about this paper. Tell us where there's repetition that we can trim. Tell us whether there are references or citations that we missed. It gave a 2-page summary of the paper that was better than anything I or Cam Harvey or the other authors could possibly have written. Beautiful, wonderful synopsis. Then it gave us a rundown of ways to improve the paper. We took most of its suggestions. Then it gave us a list of 10 citations we missed. 4 of them, we looked at them and we thought, wow, why didn't we think of that? Yes, put it in. 4 of them were more borderline. We ignored them. 2 of them didn't exist. So it still hallucinates. It creates stuff out of thin air, which is something that you've got to be very careful about. But it's breathtaking. The leaders of the AI revolution are leaders today. Will they be disrupted? Disruptors get disrupted. Think of the most valuable tech stocks in the world in 2000, Microsoft. It went through a tough decade, and then it regained its footing and became the world leader that it is today. Cisco. Cisco's chairman in March of 2000 said, I don't see why we can't grow 40% a year as far as the eye can see. 40% a year means you're going to be 6 times as large in 5 years. How big are they now? They're six times as large. It took 25 years, not five.
Yeah.
It's 8%.
Yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing that we hear from NVIDIA, which, by the way, as we're speaking, has been hitting new highs. Exactly the kind of thing we hear from them, that this growth can go on indefinitely.
If you can find power stations to power I read somewhere that something like 5% of the U.S. power supply is now used by AI, and they're wanting it to double every year for the next 3 years. Well, that would take it to 40%.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful paper by Ashenbrenner, one of the co-founders of OpenAI, called Situational Awareness, that talks about the future of AI. And it's wonderful because it's so insightful on how many ways it can change the world. It's off target in a couple of ways. He says we need to increase the power generation capability of the U.S. grid by 40% by 2027. Well, maybe we should, but it's not going to happen.
and even, of course, if you manage to increase the power going into the grid, making the grid resilient enough to carry that huge
Correct.
Increase in power would be verging on impossible in a time frame like that, right? So there Right. are power constraints on AI. There are regulatory constraints on AI, maybe ethical constraints on
Yeah.
AI. And then I guess it's also the case if we stick with this comparison to the dot-com bubble and possibly even to maybe even the smartphone boom or whatever you like to call it in from 2007 on, it's around there. Chinese competition, which didn't exist in quite the same way, in the same volume then. We've moved from the similarities to the differences too quickly.
Yeah.
That is what I meant to do, but we've done it. So there's more competition, global competition, that suggests that maybe first mover advantage isn't quite what it might have been. And maybe there's a first mover disadvantage, or there certainly was in the dot-com bubble.
Yeah. Well, rounding out the top five back in 2000, you have Intel. Was that disrupted? Good Lord, yes. You've got Nokia. It still makes phones. It was fifth most valuable company on the planet back in 2000. You've got Lucent. Lucent doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's a graveyard. And the other part that's just fascinating is March of 2000, when the bubble burst, roll the clock forward 2 years. The NASDAQ was down 50% on its way to an 80% drop. Russell 2000 value, remember, value was trading cheap. Small cap was trading cheap. Again, same thing today. Russell 2000 value was up 53% in those 2 years. The bull market of the 1990s for most stocks didn't end until March of 2002. And that was 2 years into the bursting of the bubble. The big cap indexes were dragged down, but the median stock was up for those next 2 years. The same thing could play out today. I'm not predicting that, but what I am saying is that decoupling of frothy large cap popular names from very successful mainstream businesses in valuation can mean revert. And I think likely will.
Well, you say can mean revert. Historically, always have mean reverted.
Correct.
Which doesn't mean that it happens this time and
Correct.
Doesn't tell us when it might happen, but there has never previously been a point when this kind of disparity has not reverted to a historical mean of some kind,
Here's a fun factoid. Members of the S&P 500 or of the Russell 1000 are at valuation multiples that are 2.5 times as large as non-members. Now, people will say, yeah, that's because these are wonderful companies and these aren't. Pardon me, over the last 30 years, roll the clock back 30 years, they were at parity. They were about the same valuation multiples. So they blew out 150 percentage point gap opened up. These guys, the non-members, have had earnings and dividend growth 1% a year faster than the members.
Oh.
So they're better companies on average that are valued at 40% the valuation multiples of the index members. We have a short paper, Membership Has Its Privileges, that's in draft form, that examines this difference and just points out the obvious, that if you're a member of the index, membership has its privileges. You are entitled, one, to a higher valuation multiple because you're a member. Two, you're entitled to steady inflows of capital, propping the price up and holding it higher. And both of those facts are realities of today's market. Indexing has really swamped the markets and has compromised the price discovery mechanism of figuring out what companies are actually worth.
Yeah, the point being that because of the rise of passive investing, companies automatically get flows every time anyone buys an index. So the differentiation between the valuation of stocks becomes much less.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Mm. Okay, but here we are. And I think, you know, we're already talking ourselves into agreeing that this is a bubble and that it shows all the characteristics of a bubble. And then we have the few things we haven't discussed, like the insane levels of concentration in the U.S. market. And global markets. Yeah. So we've been at concentration levels like this before. Have we been quite this high? I think we have been near these levels, but
no,
it's always
a massive
danger sign. Not even near.
Not even near.
No.
This is the highest concentration in global and particularly U.S. because it's U.S. concentration that leads to the global concentration. Mm. I mean, the U.S. is 2/3 of the world's stock market. It's 3/4 of the developed world stock market. So if the Magnificent Seven, 30% of the U.S. stock market, they're 20% of the world stock market, these seven companies. And yes, they're magnificent. Yes, they have product that everybody wants. Yes, they have product that everyone needs. Yes, they're reshaping the future of the world. But this is a competitive landscape. Look at Intel. I mean, even the CHIPS Act couldn't save Intel. And a $50 billion infusion from the U.S. government couldn't help it defend itself against the rise of NVIDIA because NVIDIA disrupted them. And disruption is normal. Disruption happens regularly in a healthy capital economy. Creative destruction is a real thing. If you are behind the curve, you're going to lose business and lose market share and be pushed aside. And that's actually a good thing. It means that the better ideas get a chance to gain traction and grow. And these seven companies are all disruptors and are all very powerful in their industry, but none of them is immune to competition. NVIDIA's already got a number of organizations lapping at their heels with new super chips that are in some ways better than NVIDIA's. NVIDIA got a head start, which was tremendous. The story behind that's also fun. Jensen Huang said, these super chips that we're building, let's save some real estate on them and just not fill it with circuitry, because the next round of circuitry is going to be better and we won't have to redesign the whole chip. Who builds a chip with dead space in it? It was a stroke of genius. It allowed them to plunk in the new, better stuff faster, a year or two faster than they would have otherwise. And boy, what a stroke of genius. So these are brilliant companies. That was his disruption of the whole silicon industry.
I suppose one thing we should just say as an aside is that it's not the concentration in itself that is necessarily a problem. And the UK stock market is also very concentrated. You know, a very large percentage of it is just our biggest stocks. But part of the problem with this concentration is the correlation. So they're all in the same industry, all in the same business. And if you look at the UK market, for example, while we have concentration, the big companies are generally in different businesses. So it's both things, the concentration and the correlation between them, right?
Yes.
And the business connections between them, of course.
Here's a couple of fun factoids. The market value of the Magnificent Seven was $20 trillion at the end of September. That's bigger than all stock markets in Europe combined. That's bigger than all of the Chinese stock market. Basically, the market's value for a company is supposed to be the market's best guess at future profit distributions back to the shareholders, discounted back to today, so the net present value of future profits. What the market is saying is that the future profits of these seven companies will exceed all profits generated by all of Europe, bigger than all profits generated by all of China. Is that possible? Yes.
Yeah.
Is that likely? I don't think so. these companies compete against one another. NVIDIA's 50% profit margins are not going to continue more than two or three more years because competition is coming into play. If they're, roll the clock forward 10 years, if they are 40% of the superchip market instead of 90, if their profit margins are still a robust 30%, not 50, if the pricing power means that revenues per chip are down by two-thirds over the next 10 years, and that's probably conservative. Plug those into a spreadsheet, and what you find is, okay, goodness, their 2035 profits are going to be no better than their 2025 profits, and yet they're priced as if they're going to see stupendous growth. Palantir is another fabulous example. How many companies get to be priced at triple-digit multiples of sales, not of profits? It peaked at 180 times sales. So with sales last year of 2 to 3 billion, they're worth about 400 billion. Now, how do you justify 400 billion market cap when your sales are 2 to 3 billion? The only way to do it is to have those sales grow to 20 billion, 40 billion, 100 billion, and profits to match, and do that fast enough. Is that possible? Yeah. Is it likely? I don't think so. So I see bubbles galore. I also see some very profitable, highly successful companies priced at premium multiples, but not nosebleed levels. And so I think there's a lot of stocks in this bubble that are not nonsensically priced. And
yeah.
That's a good thing. That's a healthy side of the market.
Okay. I get the slight feeling that you don't think it's quite ready to burst yet. We're not quite at, Cisco levels.
Well, some of them are at Cisco level. Cisco crested it in early 2000 at 180 times earnings, and Palantir is way past that.
I was just want to read that one sentence that you write in this report, which I think kind of sums up everything you're saying, which is just very simple. Fast developing sectors riding waves of innovation and optimism are inherently volatile, which is what you mean when you talk about the regular disruption of these things. And one of the extraordinary things about a bubble is that inside the stories that people tell themselves inside a bubble, that the general narrative that develops, there is no volatility. There isn't competition. There isn't the disruptors remain the disruptors. They do not become the disrupted. That's how the story works.
Exactly.
And the thing that tends to break these bubbles is either, it's a change in the cost of capital, it's a change in the wider environment, or it's the realization that the narrative doesn't include the next wave of disruption.
Yeah. And people talk about the jobs lost. Every technological revolution since the Industrial Revolution has destroyed millions of jobs. The thing is that painful to those whose jobs or whose families' members' jobs get destroyed. Yes. Do people care about those job losses a generation later? No. The thing that is different is that the computers will be more intelligent than we are in the not-too-distant future. In some ways, they already are. My CEO, Chris Brightman, likes to play with AI every weekend for 3 to 5 hours, testing its capabilities. And he had a conversation with GPT-5 about how AI fits in the realm of human evolution. And it gave a discourse, short discourse, that was so insightful, you'd think it was from a double PhD in anthropology and philosophy. And it closed with the observation, we don't know yet whether human intelligence and machine intelligence will merge, or whether human intelligence will at some stage be a fond and distant memory for AI. And then it closes with the sentence, the wonderful thing in this revolution is that we get to choose. And I thought, who the heck is we?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question, isn't
it?
Who is we in this context? I don't think it's me. It might be you, but I'm not feeling like it's me.
But anyway, existential threat, Yeah. Do I worry about that? I don't, because I try to worry about things I can have any influence over. This revolution is coming and it's big. But who's going to be the disruptor in the coming decade? Who will be the market leaders 10 years from now? Some of market leaders today will be the market leaders in 10 years. Some won't. They're all priced as if they will be the market leaders.
I'll be back again with something similar tomorrow.